Hi, this is Cale Clark. Welcome back to The Faith Explained. We're starting a brand new mini-series for you today. It's called Bogus or Biblical, The False Gospels and the Real Jesus. You see, just as surely as the poinsettias proliferate at Christmas time and lilies abound in your parish church at Easter, around the times of big, big Catholic feasts, and at other times of the year as well, all kinds of crackpot theories about Jesus and the Gospels will appear in the media, taking advantage of the fact that at these times of year, people are naturally more interested in religious things, in learning about Christ. And one of the things that you'll hear is that there are a number of other quote-unquote Gospels that exist. In fact, it might surprise you to know that there are such documents. In fact, there's about 30 of them. And the implication is that the church has been hiding these from you all along. They don't want you to know about them because they contain the secret truth about Jesus that will set you free. That's kind of the narrative that's out there. But is it in fact legitimate? Do these quote-unquote gospels actually give us more reliable information about Jesus than Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John do in the Bible? Well, we're going to look at that question in this series. And we're specifically going to look at five of these so-called gospels. As I said, there's about 30 of them. We're going to focus on the five that are, in fact, the most well-known. We're going to talk about the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Peter. There's another gospel called the Egerton Gospel, the Gospel of Mary, and also the Secret Gospel of Mark. And you say, Cale, what about the so-called Gospel of Judas? Well, I'll talk about that as well. That's a more recent discovery, but we will deal with that one in this series a little bit too. Now, by the way, as you'll know, if you've listened to me for a little while here on Relevant Radio, you'll know that I do make use of writings about Jesus outside of the Bible, outside of the New Testament, for a reason. They help to establish the fact that Jesus really existed. Now, one of the crackpot theories that you'll hear sometimes in the media or on the internet is that there really was no such person as Jesus of Nazareth. He's simply a made-up figure by the church. Nothing could be further from the truth. There are secular history writers that wrote about Jesus. I'm talking about the Roman historian Tacitus. I'm talking about Pliny the Younger, who was a very famous government official who wrote about the problem of the early church and the problem of the early Christians in the Roman Empire. There are lots of writers that make reference to Jesus. Josephus, the great Jewish historian of the times. There's plenty of evidence that Jesus existed even outside of the Bible. And sometimes these writings of historians and sometimes even writers from the early church period, like the early church fathers who did believe in Jesus, can help us to piece together what was going on at the time of Jesus and as the church was getting going. Also, the Dead Sea Scrolls, they are not Christian documents. You've heard me talk about them as well. The Dead Sea Scrolls are important, not because they talk about Jesus specifically, they don't, but they do shed light on what people were thinking about the Messiah around the time that Jesus appeared on the scene, what they were expecting. St. Paul as well, not a gospel writer, of course, things that he wrote, letters that St. Paul wrote. We recently did a big study on his letter to the Romans on the Faith Explained show. Paul, of course, did not write a gospel, but in his letters, we learn an awful lot about what Jesus said and what Jesus did. In fact, the earliest reference that we have in the Bible to the Mass, to the words of institution, this is my body, this is my blood, they actually come from not a gospel, but from St. Paul's letter, first letter to the Corinthians. So this helps us to understand Jesus very, very well. So there's nothing wrong with appealing to sources outside of the Gospels and even outside of the Bible to try to learn more about Jesus. But what is troubling is sometimes the very uncritical acceptance of some other documents that are floating around out there that are called Gospels, that purport to be about Jesus, that even allegedly have some secret sayings of Jesus in them, and just saying, well, they must be real. They must be accurate. Indeed, the church has been hiding these from me. Well, this is what we're going to deal with. We're going to show you that that is, in fact, not the case. Spoiler alert. And I learned an awful lot about this, by the way, from my professor, Dr. Craig Evans. And one book that you might want to check out is a book that he wrote called Fabricating Jesus. And Scott Hahn gave a little blurb on the cover promoting this book. And also Dr. Scott Hahn told me that he believes that Dr. Craig Evans is in fact the greatest living New Testament scholar today. I was very privileged to be able to learn from Dr. Evans and I'll be sharing with you what I learned from him. I have to pass it on. I can't just keep it to myself. It's just too good. And traveling to Israel with him, working on archaeological digs, interviewing scholars, I really was able to be immersed in some of the historical context of the life of Jesus of Nazareth. And so let's take a look at what these documents actually are. The first thing we want to do is try to figure out when they were written. Let's get our dates right, first of all. Jesus of Nazareth was ministering, teaching around the decades of the late 20s in the first century and the early 30s as well. When did he die? When was he crucified? Well, scholars usually say it's either 30 AD or 33 AD. St. Paul, the very earliest documents in the New Testament written by St. Paul. The Gospels came later. Paul started writing his letters probably in the decade of the 40s, the late 40s, early 50s, continued on until the mid 60s. Now, I personally believe that all of the four New Testament Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, I think they were all written, I think they were all done before the year 70 AD, within one generation, 40 years of the death of Jesus. That's also the year, of course, that the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed in this great war with the Romans from 66 to 70 AD, the first great Jewish war with Rome. And so not one New Testament document, incredibly, not one New Testament document mentions the destruction of the temple, even though Jesus predicted the temple would be destroyed. I don't think they would have passed up a chance to say, hey, Jesus told you so. That to me tells me that all of these documents, not just the Gospels, but all the New Testament documents, right up to the book of Revelation, were all done prior to 70 AD. But that's not usually the consensus among biblical scholars. Most people think that the Gospel of Mark was written somewhere between the year 60 to 70 AD. And then the Gospel of Luke, the Acts of the Apostles, and by the way, the Acts of the Apostles was also written by Luke, the beloved doctor, the beloved physician, missionary companion of St. Paul. Acts of the Apostles is really part two of the Gospel of Luke. And the scholars tend to date Luke and Acts as well as the Gospel of Matthew somewhere between 75 to 80 AD, with the Gospel of John being the latest one. And scholars have tended to date John as late as the 90s, maybe 90 to 95 AD. I don't think any of them were that late, but even if they were that late, that's not really a problem for us. What about these other Gospels, like the Gospel of Thomas and the others that I mentioned? They are late documents. They are second century documents, late second century at best. If you're looking for documents that'll get you close to the Jesus of history, close in time, these are not great candidates at all. Just think about the Gospel of Mark, which was the first of the four Gospels that were written in the Bible. Even if you take this late date from Mark, it's still written within one generation of the crucifixion of Jesus. Thousands of people who actually knew of Jesus, came in contact with Jesus during his ministry, were still alive walking around in Jerusalem, in the Holy Land. What about elements of Matthew and Luke? Same thing. So it would have been very, very difficult for a gospel that misrepresented the life and teaching of Jesus to have really gotten any traction in the first century when so many followers of Jesus, so many people who actually heard him, in some cases were even healed by him, were walking around. They could say, you know what? That stuff never really happened. He never taught that. He never did that. So I think these are really, really good historical, accurate documents, the Gospels, that get us very, very close to the actual ministry of Jesus. And don't forget, St. Paul, who's writing even earlier than that, talks about the Last Supper, talks about the First Mass, talks about the crucifixion, death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. St. Paul became a convert in the 30s, and he actually got to know the actual apostles, at least some of them, pretty well, especially Peter, James, and John. When he visited Jerusalem, he hung out with Peter for 15 days, and they just talked about Jesus for about 2 weeks. He knew James, of course, who was a relative of Jesus, became the author of the book of James in the New Testament, became the bishop of Jerusalem and a martyr himself. So he certainly was in contact with people who knew Jesus, the men who knew the man, the God-man. So that is simply not the case in terms of authenticity for these other quote-unquote gospels that you might be hearing about in the media. You're listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm your host, Cale Clark. Okay, so what about these alleged gospels that didn't make it into the Bible? Well, all of these extra canonical gospels, and by the way, that simply means that it's outside extra the canon. And the canon is the list of books in the Bible. So extra canonical gospels. These were written in the second century or maybe even later. Now, some might say, well, yeah, even if they were written somewhere between AD 140 to AD 160, 180, mid to late second century, some of the people who purport that this stuff contains legit information about Jesus, they'll say, well, you know, they might have been written later, but the stuff that's in there goes back to Jesus' time. Well, we'll just see about that. But for most scholars, they say that they're just written way, way too late. The Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Peter, the Gospel of Mary. They're written way too late to give us any accurate historical information about Jesus. In fact, some of them were written a whole century, 100 years after the Gospels in the New Testament were put together. Now, you might recall, speaking of sensational items about Jesus in the media. Back in the early 1990s, there were a group of scholars, mostly American scholars, known as the Jesus Seminar. And they had a lot of wild theories about Jesus, and they got into a lot of media publications at the time when magazines were still the currency of the day. Before the internet really took off, of course, we're talking about Time Magazine, we're talking about Newsweek. I remember seeing them on the cover of Newsweek magazine. And they actually published a book, this group of scholars known as the Jesus Seminar. They published a book called The Five Gospels. Now, of course, the fifth gospel was, guess what? The Gospel of Thomas. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Thomas. They put Thomas right up there with the canonical gospels of the New Testament. And they were very famous. They got a lot of attention for voting on what they think Jesus actually said in the Gospels. It would include Thomas in this as well. And they would vote with beads. They took these colored beads and they would vote about whether or not Jesus really said something. If it was a red bead, that meant, yep, he definitely said it. You've probably all seen red letter editions of the New Testament with the words of Jesus in red ink. Well, if they voted with a red bead, that means that they thought Jesus really said something that's written in the Gospels. A pink bead would mean, well, he probably said it, maybe not, but he probably did. A gray bead would mean, oh, it's really doubtful that he said this. And then a black bead would mean, no, Jesus never said this at all, according to them. So that created a huge firestorm of media publicity. And one of the reasons why this got into the media, and Dr. Evans used to say this all the time, these skeptical scholars get a lot of press coverage because of the fact that what they're saying is new, right? And what is the news media focused on? They're focused on things that are new. They're looking for clicks. They're looking for eyeballs. They're looking for an audience to attract advertisers. So if they're interviewing scholars that say, oh yeah, you can completely trust the four Gospels in the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, these are our best sources for knowing about the real Jesus of history, that's not going to get on the news. that's not a new angle. That's not kind of a sexy angle that's going to attract people. But if you say you can't trust the New Testament, in fact, there are secret gospels that have the real inside scoop about Jesus. Oh, that is going to get you a lot of attention. Well, also in the early 1990s, one of the leading proponents of the Jesus Seminar, and I've talked about him many times on The Faith Explained and also on The Cale Clark Show, Dr. John Dominic Crossan. John Dominic Crossan has written a lot about Jesus, and he is very, very skeptical, to say the least. He's an ex-Catholic priest. I'm not sure what happened there, but at some point he had a crisis of faith, it seems. And so he's written a lot about Jesus, but he does not believe, for one, he does not believe that Jesus was even buried, let alone that he rose from the dead physically in a resurrected body. He thinks that Jesus' body was hung on the cross, and then after he died, his body was simply thrown into a shallow grave, maybe covered over with a little bit of dirt, and then his body was consumed by wild dogs. In fact, he even has a chapter in one of his books called The Dogs Beneath the Cross. So he doesn't even believe Jesus got a proper burial, let alone was resurrected. There is absolutely no reason to believe this, and there's plenty of reasons to believe that Jesus did get a proper burial and was resurrected. There's great historical evidence for this, but that's just a sample of where he's at. In 1991, he published a very, very important study about Jesus in history, and in that same year, 1991, another great Jesus scholar, Father John Meyer, Professor John P. Meyer, who spent many, many years teaching at Notre Dame University in South Bend, Indiana, he published his first in a series of books about Jesus in history called A Marginal Jew. Now, Dr. John Meyer, Father John Meyer, is a legendary Jesus scholar. In fact, I had the great opportunity to correspond with him. I've met him in person. Now, these two guys take completely different views of these other gospels and whether or not they're useful in finding out anything about the real Jesus. John Dominic Crossan thinks they're absolutely fantastic, loves the Gospel of Thomas. Professor John Meyer, Father John Meyer, said, you know what? These writings are essentially not worth the papyrus that they were written on. They don't tell us anything legit about Jesus. Here's a quote, a powerful quote from Father John Meyer, Professor John P. Meyer, about this. He says, quote, contrary to some scholars, I do not think that the apocryphal gospels, and these are these gospels outside of the New Testament, in particular the Gospel of Thomas, I do not think they offer us reliable new information or authentic sayings that are independent of the New Testament. What we see in these later documents is rather imaginative Christians reflecting popular piety and legend, and Gnostic Christians, and I'm going to explain to you later who these Gnostic Christians were, Gnostic Christians developing a mystic speculative system. It is only natural for scholars, to say nothing of popularizers, to want more, to want other access roads to the historical Jesus. This is understandable, but it's not always a critical desire. I think this is what has recently led to the high evaluation in some quarters of the apocryphal gospels as sources for the quest. Now listen to what Professor Meyer says here. He says, it is a case of the wish being father to the thought, but the wish is a pipe dream. For better or for worse, in our quest for the historical Jesus, we are largely confined to the canonical gospels. The genuine corpus is infuriating in its restrictions. For the historian, it's a galling limitation. But to call upon the gospel of Peter or the gospel of Thomas to supplement our four gospels is to broaden out our pool of sources from the difficult to the incredible. End of quote. So in particular, when he says the wish is father to the thought, but the wish is a pipe dream. That's such a powerful quote. So in other words, yeah, inquiring minds want to know. And yeah, if we could know more about Jesus, that would be incredible. But are these documents actually good sources about Jesus? I don't think so. But the fact that people are buying into them means they have a skewed image of what Jesus and who he is, what he's really all about. In our next episode, we're going to look at maybe the most famous of these bogus gospels, the Gospel of Thomas. We'll tell you what it is, what it's all about, and what it's not about in the next episode of The Faith Explained. But stay tuned, because right now we're going to open up our Faith Explained Q&A mailbag. Okay, as we open up our Faith Explained Q&A mailbag once again, I want to remind you that you can send in your question. Always good to get your questions. Need a few more? And you can send them to me at faith@relevantradio.com. That's the email address, faith, F-A-I-T-H, at relevantradio.com. And you can also find me on the X app. My handle is at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. And this question comes to me via email. And it's from Susan, who's listening in Chicago on 950 AM Relevant Radio. And it's about broken rosary. She says, hello, Cale, what is the proper protocol for the disposal of broken rosaries? Well, Susan, I'm really glad you asked that question, because it doesn't just touch upon what we should do with broken rosaries, for example, but also the bigger question of what we should do with blessed items or objects when they are no longer useful, they become broken, something happens to them. How are we to dispose of them, or are we to dispose of them? Well, Father William Saunders, who for many years wrote a great column for the Arlington Catholic Herald, he dealt with this question, and he noted that when an object is blessed by a priest or a bishop, it often denotes that this object, whatever it might be, a rosary, for example, it's sort of set aside for a holy purpose, a sacred purpose. And so once something like this is blessed, a statue or a rosary, something, then you have to treat it in a bit of a different way, with great reverence. You can't use it in a profane way, in sort of a common way. It's set apart for sacred use. And for those of you who are canon law buffs, you can check out the Code of Canon Law number 1171 for more information on that. But very often, sometimes these items break, and a rosary might fall apart. A statue might even break. And I can tell you that one of the tensest moments in my marriage to Patricia happened when I accidentally broke a statue of Our Lady, which was a statue of Our Lady, and I somehow knocked it down. It broke. Our Lady's head came off. Oh, it was horrible. And let's just say that she wasn't very happy about that. So what do you do in this case? Another example is palms from Palm Sundays. You bring them home, and they get pretty dry. What's to be done with them? What if it's next Palm Sunday, you get a brand new fresh palm? What do you do with one from last year? Well, usually the protocol is you burn these items, like the palms. And in fact, that's where the ashes for Ash Wednesday come from. They come from the burning of palms from the previous year's Palm Sunday. Or you bury these broken religious blessed items. And during the 1800s, 19th century, the Sacred Congregation for Rites, and also the Holy Office, and what was also known as the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith at the time, they issued a lot of directives about this very, very thing. So, for example, a chalice, which used to be used at Mass, you cannot sell these chalices afterwards. Father Saunders mentioned like going on eBay and seeing things online. Tragically, vestments that were used at Mass, chalices used by priests at Mass, that people would sell. And this is absolutely improper from a church law point of view. Any vestments, altar cloths, linens used in sacred worship, they must be destroyed if they're no longer being used. Holy water. How do you get rid of holy water if something's wrong with it, it's become polluted in some way? You have to pour it into the ground. You have to burn the palms. You have to take a broken rosary or a religious statue. Normally, you would bury this thing. And he talked about when he was younger, that in the spring planting season, his mother would actually bury the broken rosaries underneath the new plants. It's kind of interesting. And archaeologists, maybe when they dig up our culture many, many decades and hundreds of years from now, they'll hopefully find out that, hey, we were religious people. And these buried rosaries will pay testament to that. So the bottom line is, we never throw out something that has been dedicated to God, the same way that with a person's body, we're all consecrated to Christ by virtue of our baptism. We don't throw out our bodies. They're very sacred, and God's going to resurrect them on the last day. We commit them to the earth. So again, the rule of thumb, anything that has been blessed should either be burned and the ashes buried, or simply straight up buried. We live in a disposable society, that is for sure, but religious objects are not to be treated that way. If they've been dedicated to God, if they had been set aside for holy use, we've got to make sure that the way we dispose of them when they are no longer serviceable is in the way that the church has intended. So that's a really, really good question, Susan. I hope that that helps your decisions about what to do with your broken rosaries. And if you guys have questions for me here on The Faith Explained, here's how to get them my way. Once again, you can send them to me via email. You can send them to this email address, faith@relevantradio.com, faith@relevantradio.com. And you can also find me on social media. It's my only social media right now. It's the X app, formerly known as Twitter. My handle there is @CaleClark, C-A-L-E, Clark with in E. Well, don't forget, keep it locked right here on Relevant Radio all throughout the day. Do me a favor. If you enjoy the Faith Explained program, I'd like you to go into the Relevant Radio app and try to share this episode with a friend. There are very easy sharing tools within our app, and perhaps you're listening on Apple Podcasts. We have many listeners who do that, and also on Spotify, another service. If that's your bag, also, we would ask you to please spread the word about this show. Tell your friends about it on social media. You can text them episodes of The Faith Explained and all of our fine programs as well on Relevant Radio. I'll be back later today for The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, and I hope to talk to you then live on that show. But keep it locked here all throughout the day and night. Coming up next on Relevant Radio, it's the great Father Simon Says. It's Father Richard Simon with his incredible blend of humor and insight. Hope you'll stay tuned for that. And thank you for joining me today. Cale Clark here for The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. See you soon. God bless.